Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Oh, tonight we got them. Goldie the Sulk and JC.
Disgusting.
And it starts right now.
So, welcome back to another episode of A Typical Disgusting Display, a podcast for writers by writers who hate writing. And there was the Patrick Stump theme.
Woo.
We're going to talk to him later today, which I'm very excited for. Patrick Stump, lead singer of Fall Out Boy, will be with us here today. But we're just coming off the Super Bowl, folks.
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys watch? Did you enjoy?
I did.
Did you? Were you rooting for either team?
Yeah, I was rooting for the Chiefs. I like Mahomes. It was cool they won. I had a thing where my audio, I have a very nice hi-fi system I treated myself to, accumulated the components over a number of years.
I love that.
And my audio just glitched from the beginning of the game to the end, and it's going to be like maybe a $1,200 repair.
So, no, that's
I was just angry the entire game.
Of course.
The wicked glitch of the West. We were talking yesterday. We actually enjoyed some of the commercials. Maybe it's because we're getting older and like softer somehow, but I particularly enjoyed the Dunkin' Donuts commercial.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. No, this is how you know you're becoming like a just corny out of it.
Idiot. I loved it. When those stars from my era were back up there. I thought that one was very funny. But Goldie, you liked one in particular, which we watched in the room yesterday and was very funny.
Oh, the Reese's one the people were bashing their heads in the wall and jumping out the window and then they jumped back through the window. It was like Airplane to me. Whoever did that.
Yeah.
I take my hat off to you. It was 30 seconds that I enjoyed. And then, of course, I had to tell everyone in my house. I was like, that was a good commercial.
Right. Like, I work in comedy. Yeah.
And just so you guys know, you appreciate that, kids.
First joke of the day. First joke of the day.
I'm yelling at my kids because they don't like a commercial.
Right. Yeah. That's funny, kids. You'll realize it later. Yeah. That was a good
Trust
one.
Me.
There was the one for Jesus where he washed everybody's feet.
Yeah.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah.
Is that really going to get people where you go, hey, I know. Okay. You don't know about this thing. Everyone else does, but you haven't heard of it. But basically, you're going to go from nothing to washing people's feet.
You know,
I have no reason.
As someone, I watched that and I said, you know what? My feet are filthy. Maybe this is the thing for me. Maybe I can get in on this universal foot bath that Jesus seems to be into.
Also, no one wants wet feet.
I know. Never.
I know.
Never. There were no towels in the ad. It would look like a disaster. I don't want to put my socks back on. The second that commercial started, I knew what it was for. And everyone in the room, we were at a little party with some other parents. And what is this? I'm like, it's Jesus. And I was walking away to get snacks. So I think the appearance was sort of given like, oh, this Jewish guy doesn't like this Jesus commercial. It's like, I don't care. But like, I knew what it was. And I was just like, time to get some Fritos. overall the beginning of the game was kind of boring and then it got exciting at the end and it was
as someone who just really dislike Brock Purdy and everything about it.
Oh,
it
was so funny.
He proved you right.
I know. That was the best part.
What don't you like about him, out of curiosity?
He's fine, but like the whole thing, he's not good. Like, he isn't good. He is surrounded by excellence and in the middle, and you can take any of these quarterbacks we bash and make fun of. Zach Wilson is as good as or better than Brock Purdy.
That's controversial. Okay. That's controversial.
Fine. It's right.
That's a hot take.
Patrick Mahomes is good.
Yes.
Brock Purdy's not good.
No, he's nothing like Mahomes. Nothing like Mahomes. Go ahead, Jason.
I was torn because I didn't realize this at the time, but I was rooting for the Chiefs. And then I realized,
Wait, not your team.
I know. I really, at one point, I was like, wait a minute. I should be rooting for the Niners. So I was like, okay, go Niners. But then every time Kansas City did something, I was like, I was more excited.
Yeah,
for
you
them.
Can feel it inside. That's a good thing. You know, for me, because I went into this Super Bowl thinking like there's no bad outcome. Because growing up, I liked the 49ers. They were my NFC team because I like Joe Montana.
Joe Montana.
Yes. And Stevie. Also, I like the Chiefs, you know, story with Kelce and Taylor Swift. And I love that it sort of drives the right crazy. Oh. So I was thinking like,
Well, I'm fine with it, but Kelce sucks.
Gronk is better. Gronk is better.
Diva Las Vegas thing was one of the worst moments I think I've ever witnessed on live TV. I was like, this sucks. And he just sang the whole thing. Like,
yeah,
he kind of stinks. He's way beneath her. I don't know what she's doing. It's crazy.
It's like America's homecoming king and queen.
Yes. I hear it's all about the SEX, folks. I hear that's what it's all about.
Think about that.
From who?
Through the grapevine. Through my sources. Right. Okay. And you know, folks, while I have you here, men of a certain age.
Oh, my God.
Please get your colon checked.
Wear your brown ribbon. And
your brown ribbon. Or your brown flag pin. I'll be doing that every week now. But it was a very interesting game. It was fun to the end. And there was no negative outcome for me. It was, you know, I wanted a good game and it turned out to be a good game. So that was nice. I know we're kind of hustling through today, but have we all seen the We Are the World documentary?
I have.
Yeah. Great, right?
Yeah.
Yes. However, I feel like they left out a lot of footage. I've seen footage like just on the World Wide Web that was more controversial, that would have been more interesting, like Dylan really struggling. I've seen footage of
him.
They
showed that. They had that in the documentary.
No, but the footage that I saw was like humiliating. Like,
no, this was humiliating as well, I thought.
I thought it was way worse. The stuff that I've seen is way worse. It's like, is he okay? Like, he seems like brain damaged. There's a reason why they left it out.
Made that point maybe a little more subtly than the footage you've seen, but I did love that. Go ahead.
Just want to point out something that I noticed that was hilarious to me was that, you know, so they said the studio was getting hot and everyone was getting grumpy, and then you looked and I remembered this was before bottled water. Yes. Like, bottled water was invented. Yes. So literally no one had water and they didn't know what to do. Wow. So they were just getting hot because there was no way to get water.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
So it was unintentionally mirroring the experience of Africa itself.
It was like a documentary about how stupid we were. That you go, if only there was a way for me to be holding water.
It was the genesis of Jim Gaffigan's bit. How dumb do I think the Americans are?
Yeah. No, and it brought you back to like, oh, right. When bottled water came out, people were like, wait, I'm going to pay for water.
Know, it's
like,
so
well, it's the most important thing. Yeah.
That's funny. I did not notice that. A couple of hilarious things, and we can move on quickly. Al Jarreau being drunk was hilarious.
I didn't know that part.
Like him
great.
Bumping into Willie Nelson, like trying to get to the microphone. It was such an odd combination.
I know.
And then who would have picked, you know, the odds before the game of this recording, having Kim Carnes, Huey Lewis, and Cyndi Lauper be the MVPs was unlikely. But they crushed it. That was such an awesome part.
Yes.
Oh my God.
I agree.
All so fun to watch. And JC, you must have, like, you know, as someone who's been in the studio many, many times.
Yes.
That is a unique studio experience. Like,
oh,
you
yeah.
don't you don't have giants like that together, first of all, and then you don't have them singing at each other in like a U-shape.
And sharing a mic and
incredible.
Incredible. And also, being yelled at by Quincy. It's just like...
Speaking of scoring, which we are going to in this interview, I know, my high school friend Go Nakamura did the music for this documentary.
What?
And it was great. It was great music. He really because he really captured the 80s with that soundtrack. It was really cool. I noticed it several times when they inserted music. I'm like, oh, that's a cool little bit of music there. The whole thing was great. And we recommend it. Watch it on Netflix. It's called The Greatest Night in Pop. It's so fun. And Michael Jackson is godlike.
Oh my
He's just godlike. The way his voice is better than everyone's. He looked so fucking cool. It was awesome to see. And of course, we talked about on here Lionel Richie saying, I don't remember who came up with the phrase, we are the world, if it was me or Michael. I'm like, okay, that means it was Michael. You would remember that. Anyway.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
That was awesome. And something a little less awesome, Johnny Jokes.
From Hollywood, we've got none of the stars. Here's Johnny.
Oh, boy. Time to power through the garbage today. Well, maybe you heard this story. Best Western Hotels is planning on adding more rooms to their buildings by shrinking their current rooms. The only other change is that the guest quarters will now be called guest eighths. Not worth it. Not worth fucking it up. Here we go. Timothy Chalamet will play the lead role in a stage production of Romeo and Juliet. The play is slated to start rehearsals as soon as they cast their Romeo.
I was ahead of it, but I loved it.
Thank you.
It's a good joke.
Thank you. Here's one to take away, to unredeem. Jada Pinkett Smith. Jada Pinkett Smith was in the news last week after she scared off a burglar who attempted to break into her Hollywood home. Not with a gun, she simply proposed.
Oh, shit.
Tough to be married to that woman. All right, here we go. The shooter from an incident in a Houston area megachurch has been identified as a woman. So much for that glass ceiling, eh, ladies?
Oh.
Terrible, terrible. And finally, to end on an old joke, an intact egg from the Roman Empire was discovered just north of London last week. The discussion of whether to keep it or ship it to Italy was promptly ended when James Corden sent it back.
Oh.
Ah, easy. Johnny, too.
Good.
All right. Well, Super Bowl 58 was played this weekend, and the Kansas City Chiefs defeated the San Francisco 49ers.
Woo.
The winning team was whisked to Disneyland, while losing San Francisco went back to a looted Walmart. Fine.
It's fine.
But I don't know if you've seen this. Some conservatives are saying the Chiefs' victory was a CIA plot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Evidence against it being a CIA plot, it worked.
Yes. Oh, I love that joke. Would have worked 60 years ago. I love it.
Well, a special counsel report cleared President Biden of charges but questioned whether Biden has the mental fitness to be president. The good news is the president has already forgotten about the whole thing. And finally, American porn actress Whitney White visited the country of Iran. A very embarrassing moment when they said they wanted to cover her head, and she said, oh, you mean with a cloth?
The implication there was jizz.
Jizz. She's used to having it covered with jizz.
Yeah, that was the subtext.
Yeah.
All right, those are great.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Well, folks, friends, today we've got one of my very best friends, someone I'm in touch with more than anyone outside of Stu. We've been through many things together. We met on Warped Tour in 2005, and then never stopped texting each other, pretty much.
Yeah, kept in touch forever.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. We've been to each other's weddings. We performed together. He's one of the most talented people I've ever met and known. Ooh. He pretty much plays every instrument known to man, and pretty darn well. He pretty much is like, I want to learn this instrument. Okay, I'm just going to teach myself. He is the lead singer of Fall Out Boy, songwriter, producer, and composer, Patrick Stump.
Yeah.
Welcome. Yes.
How's it going?
Also, he sings our theme song. I don't know if you knew that.
That's right. So. Thank you for that.
Yes.
Anytime.
Oh, that's the song that's sweeping anytime. The nation.
And we're not going to do a special acoustic version of it now? An
live.
Unplugged performance for the
sound the alarm acoustic.
Yes.
Patrick, we're very excited because we at Family Guy have gotten the chance to get to know you better over the last few years. You've done some great singing and voices for us, so we really appreciate that. And so, of course, you kind of had to be here with the JC connection and the Family Guy connection. It's sort of like you had no choice. So we appreciate you, succumbing to the Borg in that way.
Couldn't be happier to be assimilated.
Yes, that's awesome. That's the word I was looking for that I could not find.
Is Family Guy the realest job you've ever had? The closest to a real job?
The scoring stuff.
That's a real job.
I would say
I don't mean to denigrate musicians.
No.
I just mean that like most people would be like, that's fun. And not and Family Guy is like, that's kind of fun too. I mean, have you had a non-fun job?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yes. But Borders. I used to work at Borders.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
When I was, I was probably about 17, 18. So there was a period there where I worked at, I just went from like business to business, retail business that was on the outs. And we only know that now, you know?
Like, yeah.
So I worked at a Sam Goody and then oh I worked God. at a Borders, you know?
Nice.
And so, who was that one guy that they would bring on to, they would add him to a lot of the sitcoms in the 80s. And like, it was
Ted McGinley.
Yeah, he would show up and I'd be like, ooh, yeah, I think we're done here.
How did you know that? Those retail jobs,
I guess. So.
How did you know that?
That's because crazy. When you say there's a guy who used to show up in a lot of sitcoms in the 80s, that's Ted McGinley.
And he would get added to the cast, but like last season, then it would be, you know, it was kind of like him or a little kid. And you're like, oh, no.
this show is over.
Oh, this is getting rescheduled to a later time slot, isn't it?
All right, so you worked at Borders now, but let's go back before that because it's funny. Like, we seem to have a lot of guests that grew up in the Chicago area.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
So you are from Willamette.
I'm from Glenview, actually.
This always happens too.
And it's important. It's an important distinction because Willamette is a very nice area, and Glenview's like almost as nice in Aragon.
So Willamette people would not be excited to be associated with Glenview.
Oh, I'm teasing. Now they're basically indistinguishable. And actually, Pete, our bass player, is from Willamette. And I said that one time in an interview, like, oh, yeah, no, actually, I'm from Glenview. And he's like, oh, you know, the slums of Glenview over here, you know.
right. No, and you grew up, from what I read, again, but I also read Willamette, so who the hell knows if any of this is right. But your dad is or was a musical guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a folk singer. And it was weird because he was a folk singer, but then he also had this period in the 70s where he went through, like, he got into like fusion jazz. So it was kind of like, I don't know, like that weird period of like where Joni Mitchell had like Jaco Pastorius playing with her and that kind of stuff. It was like, he would do that kind of stuff. So like, he kind of had like two flavors, and it was like folk and blues and fusion jazz, which is like real out there, you know? So, so right out of the gate, as a little kid, I knew my dad's music was different than my friend's dad's music. You know, you go to your friend's parents' house and they'd have their Led Zeppelin records or whatever. And my dad had those, but he also had a lot of, you know, Eddie Harris and you know, Mississippi John Hurt and stuff. He had like kind of interesting records, you know. So
was he trying to guide you to music, or did you just pick it up? Because I wonder with my kids, you know, I try to encourage them, and they hate that.
do they? What do you encourage them in?
I play guitar, you know, and I'm kind of like, hey, you want to sit down at the piano, or can we I don't really know how to teach someone else how to do it, but also they see me do it and they're not interested.
Yeah, I always just kind of, I remember when I was a kid that if I had access to a thing and I was interested in it, I would do it. I try to have stuff around. So I'm like, it was very important to me that there's a piano in the house, whether or not anyone's playing piano, just the idea. Cause I remember being a little kid and being like, if I had a piano, I would play it right now. I remember thinking that specifically, and I didn't, you know, we didn't have access to one. So my brother had,
I mean, you weren't in Willamette, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We only pianos growing trees there. You know?
So anyway, but you were asking about my dad. My dad was pretty encouraged. My dad's also this kind of weird Zen guy. He didn't really ever push anything on me. He would just kind of like, when I would go and stay with them on the weekends or whatever, he'd be like, so we're going to go to a show. And there would be a free concert at Grant Park in Chicago. All summer they would do these free concerts, and we'd just go to like all of them. And like, I was like eight, and we would go and see, like, I saw Spirit. I saw, I saw The Band. I saw like so many.
Oh, wow. That's, you know, cool.
Yeah. And it was just like, I would just hang out with my dad and go do that. So I don't know that. I was really into music. I always was. So it wasn't like something that I don't remember, you know, people will ask like, you know, so how did you get into music? I'm like, I don't know. I don't remember. You know?
Yeah. Well, you're like a decade younger than we are. So I'm wondering I'll say it was probably CDs. Like what were the first few CDs or albums you remember getting for yourself and being like, oh, I love this.
So the first one I ever bought was actually a cassette of Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill.
Yeah, great.
Which I bought at a Circuit City in like Niles or something. But the first one I ever owned, I really liked that Genesis song, The Way That I Walk.
Oh, yeah, I can't dance.
Yeah, so I really liked that song. Amazing. And I asked my parents for it for Christmas. I was like, I want this record. And so Christmas morning, you know, I was at my dad's house, my dad got it for me, and it was a long box, you know. So I opened up the wrapping, I opened up the long box, and it was Genesis, The Way We Walk or something was the name of it. Neither my dad nor I knew this, but that was the name of a two-disc set live album as well. That came out around the same time. Wow. That song wasn't on that record.
That's weird.
It was like there were two discs that were sold separately, and I got like disc two or something. And so it had like old Genesis on it.
Yeah.
With Peter Gabriel or?
No, it was live with Phil Collins, but they were playing like a set old of songs. Like, I just remember Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, which is like,
that's a good one.
And I haven't gone back to it, so I might be wrong, but this live version was like 13 minutes long or something. Right. You know? Oh my God. And I was eight, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was like,
this is not a 3 minute pop song. No, right. Signed not up for this. Well, it's interesting. Let's camp on Phil Collins here for a minute because.
Good, yes.
Yeah.
Good
I've noticed some. Thank you. I've noticed something in the last decade or so. Phil Collins takes an inordinate amount of shit from people.
Yes.
Like, I feel like there's this weird popular thing of like, oh, you know, Phil Collins sucks. To me, Phil Collins is great. Like, I don't know. Why do you think that people sort of turned off Phil Collins?
I think Phil Collins is an interesting thing because, I mean, for starters, he's the third highest selling solo artist from a band, I think, in history.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
So it's like Paul McCartney, Michael Jackson. I don't remember who. I probably Michael Jackson, Paul McCartney, and then Phil Collins. Right.
Wow.
I don't know if Beyonce's surpassed him by now. I don't remember. But like last time I read it, that was the thing.
Yeah.
So like you got to consider like he was massive in,
huge.
You know,
like absolutely. Oversaturation, maybe.
Totally. And I think that's probably. Yeah. Janice, I think that's probably.
Can I give a what I think is the real answer? It's because he's bald. It's acceptable. Like it's just like this fool. Like if he looked, you know, if he looked like Jacob Elordi or something, it would be like, well, he's, you know, what a gifted artist. But because he's a bald doof, everyone just tees off on him.
That's where they keep the art. It's like Samson. It's
yeah. So
keep it in your hair,
because people like it's very strange. Like when you think of an 8-year-old into Phil Collins now, right? Like Phil Collins. Yeah. Was viewed, I mean, in his videos, he's portrayed as like a stud.
Yeah. Cool guy. Yeah.
And then you look at him now and you would go like, that guy had the nerve to think he was a stud. But like, we didn't have an internet. Like, we didn't know that wasn't.
Right.
Well,
right.
I don't know how tall he is. I'm very short. I'm an incredibly short man. And he looks very short.
Yeah.
So in videos he would have it was the 80s, you know, so you had the big, you know, big shoulder. So it like really accentuated it too, you know.
Yeah.
But I think really there was a great article, I think it was in Cracked like 10 years ago or something, and it was like growing up is realizing that you're probably more like Billy Joel than David Bowie, right? And then and it was like where like you could be really good at your thing. You could be like amazing at your thing, but like David Bowie was inherently cool. He had this like innate coolness or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas like Billy Joel like is cool. I'm not saying he's not cool. I'm saying that there's like, it's not like Billy Joel walks into the room and you're like, who is this? You know, like in the way that David Bowie had that, where it's like you, whoever you are probably more likely to be that. Right.
Right.
And I feel like Phil Collins is like that, where he's like the most successful version, like, you know, where he's just amazing at the thing he does, right?
Can I put a theory forward? So I I think what you're saying is that there are people who, if you didn't know Billy Joel was Billy Joel and could play the Billy Joel songs and had crafted them, you would look at him and think, what a schlub. But David Bowie would walk in and he would command the room if you had no idea he was a musician because of his looks.
I don't necessarily want to say, but I don't want to say the schlub thing because I know which category I fall in. So I'm not necessarily going to say that Billy Joel's a schlub. More that Billy Joel is, you know, the thing that commands attention about him is he's an amazing pianist and an amazing songwriter and whatever. So that's the thing that, you know,
right?
That walks in the room. You know, David Bowie, he would just, you know, look at you or something and it was like, whoa, you know?
he's electric
He really is.
It's funny that you skipped from Phil Collins right to Billy Joel, because these are two people, and I know we love Billy Joel, and I saw Billy Joel last year when he came to SoFi, and he had Stevie Nicks was opening.
Oh, cool.
And so that was a really fun show, but a very interesting thing played out that I think speaks to you know, Goldie's schlub remark and sort of our theories about Bowie versus Joel. So during Stevie Nicks' set, Billy Joel comes out to do one song with her. And then the same thing happens during Billy Joel's set. Stevie Nicks comes out to join him for a song. Here's the thing. So Stevie Nicks, you know, was the epitome of cool. You know, when Fleetwood Mac was at the top of their game, she was the hottest. You know, she was cool. She had a great voice. The band was cool. Billy Joel was never cool in that way. He has great songs. So there was this interesting dynamic, like when Stevie Nicks came out with Billy Joel, everybody's applauding, and Billy Joel goes over to like really gets into her personal space to give her like a big hug. She wanted no part of it. You could, you could read that body language from up in the crowd. And the same thing happened during Billy Joel's set when Stevie Nicks came back. He went in for another hug and she was just like, hey, you're not the cool kid in class. Yeah. I'm still the cool kid. So do you notice that those politics and music, like if you're on tour with a bunch of different bands and you're like, oh, this guy is the fucking cool alpha.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny because I feel like I definitely relate more to the talent gets you there than being cool thing. Right. I am not cool. I was never cool. the band is really funny because, you know, Fall Out Boy has been at various times pretty successful.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's, I don't know if it's humility or obliviousness. I don't know, but I'm not really good at internalizing that or something. I don't know. Like, and I don't know, but I'm never cool. I've never been cool. And so it's weird because I'm doing scoring now, I'm doing a lot of scoring. And it's interesting because I'll talk to my friends who are composers and, you know, they're doing some, you know, elevated horror film, or they're doing, some period piece or this really interesting, you know, kind of, you know, surrealistic series or something for streaming. And I do kid shows, you know, like, right. and that's not to denigrate it at all. It's awesome. But it's like, you kind of know who you are. You know?
Right.
Like,
well, we have a version of that with comedy is sort of looked down upon by,
yeah, which I never quote, understand.
Real writers, you know,
is that true?
I get it. I didn't know that. You know, yeah. I mean, I don't, I feel like if I just took the jokes out of my writing, then I'd be like 90% of the way there.
Yes, yes. Totally.
Like I always, my joke is like when you're in a drama room, how do you know when you're done when everyone's like, well, that's not funny at all. It's really good.
We got it.
Comedy, by the way, is the thing that intimidates me the most. Comedians intimidate me the most. It's one of those things where I don't get really starstruck around anybody, you know, in terms of like rock stars or, you know, whatever. But comedians freak me out because it's like, it's so neat to be funny. Like, it's so impressive to be funny. I remember this one time I was standing behind Patton Oswalt at the at a parking garage. Now, we had done some, Fall Out Boy had done some award show or something, and Patton was one of the hosts or something, right? We really didn't have any interaction at that thing, right?
Yeah.
Whatever. But there I am at this parking garage, and I was so like, oh my God, it's Patton Oswalt, right? And right. And I kind of like, you know, he turns around and I'm like, hey, Patton Oswalt, we did that one thing together that one time. I said the thing that, you know, whatever. Yeah. And I think a lot of, you know, dramatic actors where you can really tell when they have it is when they can be funny, you know? Thing. Yeah. Like that's where you're like, oh no, you know.
Yes.
Adam Driver, you're like, oh, you're actually amazing, you know.
Yeah, well, we talk about that a lot on here, you know, when we talk about The Sopranos, which is mm-hmm. we think the yes. greatest drama show of all time, but it also happens to be one of the funniest shows. Like they can be hilarious in that show.
Well, I'm sure you've also been on the other side of the people being intimidated and starstruck, and so I was wondering, you know, I used to be like, oh, I want to get backstage at a show. And then I've been backstage and you realize, oh, I'm just bothering someone I admire. This is not like I'm not going to create a moment. But having been on the other side of that, do you have advice for people who, if they see someone they admire or they have access, how can they help have a good interaction?
Wow. I would just say you're never going to say the thing. You're never going to say the thing you think you're going to say or whatever. You know, you were always like, what am I going to say? You know, yeah. I saw Stanley in walking around in Beverly Hills one time. I had a friend who worked in Beverly Hills and we were sitting having lunch and I see Stan Lee go by and I was like,
oh God,
you know, and as we established before we started, I'm a massive comics dork. Yeah. Yeah. That's a central part of, you know, of me.
Yes.
So Stan Lee goes by and I'm like, you know, I couldn't imagine anything more that I was pretty intimidated by.
Yeah.
He comes walking back and I'm like, I'm going to do it. I never do this. I never go up to people, but I'm like, I'm going to do this. And I walked up to him and I just said, you know, hey, you know, Mr. Lee, you know, and, you know, thanks, you know, thank you for everything you do. And he shook my hand and he says, you know, thank, and he walks by. But he was obviously in a hurry and he didn't look amped. Like it was one of those things, you know, the interaction was okay, but whatever. And then I look around and I'm like, oh, you know, it's that part of Beverly Hills where it's all hospitals and like doctor's offices.
Oh, yes. Right.
He was probably going to like, you know, a proctologist. Whatever, you know, it's like not, it wasn't a great time for him, you know?
Yeah.
So, I guess my thing is more just like, be quick because you'll save yourself the thing. Cause you're probably not gonna, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you're not going to say the thing. You're not going to say the thing you're thinking of saying.
Yep. Right. Yep. I nailed it with Tom Brady. This confirms it. I nailed it when I met Tom Brady. I said, thanks for all the happy Sundays. That was it.
Oh, that's that a good. That is good.
That is Andy, our drummer.
It's fine.
It's good. It's good.
Thank
Andy,
you,
our drummer, had an amazing one with Harrison Ford. We were on one of the morning shows. I can't remember which one. And Harrison Ford was there. And they had us take a picture with him. And, you know, and none of us could say anything to him. None of us could,
of whatever.
Right.
And he looks over to us and he goes, so what song are you playing? And Andy goes,
that's good.
Andy goes, oh, this song. And he goes, well, is it a hit? and Andy's like, well, we're here, aren't we? And he's like, all right. You know, it was very cool. It was like, they both cooled each other. And it was like perfect. And I was like, how did you do that?
That's so great. Well, so let's go back to, your childhood or adolescence. So your musical growing up, you know, you have this inner desire. If there was a piano here, I'd be playing it now. Your dad has sort of filled the house with music. So when and how do you get into like your first band?
So there are like two really big important things for me besides my dad. My dad obviously is huge, is a huge influence because he had what I thought was eclectic taste, you know. That was already interesting to me. The fact that it was like, there was folk and, you know, Beach Boys and Beatles and all the stuff that, you know, a man his age would have. But then there was jazz, which was weird. It wasn't necessarily you know, prerequisite kind of thing. There's that joke in Wayne's World about, you know, about rumors coming with every suburban house. We didn't have rumors. I didn't,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those things like that was kind of like, that was interesting. But for me, the two big things were Batman, 1989's Batman, the Danny Elfman score, and the Prince record.
Yeah.
That was like incredible. Really formative for me because it was this combination of like funk. I had never heard funk before. That was really crazy. But then also Elfman, the scoring stuff like that, it was like
great,
really great. And it really, I was really little. I was probably like 5 or 6 or something. And I remember sitting at, my brother did have a keyboard eventually. I remember sitting there sounding out, you know, the beginning of Batman, the bum, 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 right. Sounding that out. And because it was so slow, you know, I could do it with one hand and then do it with the other hand. And I was like, what? You know, just music came out. And so that was something that was always there, that part of it.
Right.
And then I didn't really do anything with music beyond that until high school, middle school. It was just kind of this thing that I was always focused on, you know,
taking
playing
lessons or self-taught.
No, I did everything by myself. So then somewhere around like 9 or 10, I had found a pair of drumsticks somewhere in like a cabinet somewhere. Right. And I just started hitting on buckets and things. And I started just playing along with the radio and whatever. And so I played drums all day, all the time.
Yeah.
And so that kind of, because of that, when I was like, you know, 11 or 12 and you discover punk rock and it's a thing that you can just do, you don't have to like, there doesn't require anything else. You just get to do it. Yeah. That was kind of like, you know, off to the races. And the thing that's weird is that I don't know that I'm like the most punk rock dude. Like, I mean, I am on some level in terms of like, there's a lot of, like, I like punk rock and I like a lot of the things they say, you know, that bands have to say and stuff. But I also always had this weird kind of like half in, half out thing with it, where it was like, I really loved punk rock and I was really, you know, I was at all the shows and I, you know, was in this scene of punk rockers, but I would also then, you know, go home and put on Shostakovich or, you know, Herbie Hancock or whatever, right. Something, right. Something very, I remember I was in this band and I put on Weather Report in the car one time and it was like, it went over real bad. So,
well,
so
can I ask you, because as someone who's like, you know, always trying to improve in music, do you have any, did you then learn theory after, or were you just in your head, like you can hear intervals really well and that allows you to then find, like when you hear stuff, your ear is very good, or what, or your ear developed as you were doing this? Like, what was your approach and how did you have success?
I think I got really lucky in that my biggest talent was probably my ear, that I was able to pick out melodies and rhythms in a way that a lot of my friends couldn't. And it was weird because that's always moved faster than the rest of me. Like I couldn't, it was really frustrating trying to learn how to write music, how to like physically write it, because this was so much faster. Like the sense that I had for it was much faster than my, like, the writing it out felt like math, where I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. This is confusing.
Of course.
But then
I said it literally is like math, you know, because you're trying to put it into these symbols.
And then you're breaking down into subdivisions and you're going, okay, so that's a 16th. And then if I'm swinging it, then I'm moving this over, you know, like whatever. Yeah. There were so many different confusing things where I'm like, I don't know, let me just play it. It just made it faster. So I just kind of would, I don't know, I would figure stuff out. So it's one of those things where, for me, the music theory thing was kind of, to answer your question, Goldie, sorry, I kind of veered off of it, but I just kind of landed on it because it was kind of like, you kind of intuit certain, you know, I mean, it's probably not that different than comedy. Like I did UCB, a couple of UCB classes for a little while. And, you know, you learn the game, you know, you learn the different games and stuff and whatever. And in comedy, and it's kind of similar where it's like, you probably, after you do it, you're like, oh, I did notice that, you know, if you watch a lot of comedy and you watch improv, you're like, oh, that's the word for what they're doing, but you kind of assumed, or you kind of understood on some level,
right?
It's kind of like that, where like musically I would kind of go like, oh, you know, that's what they're doing when they do this, you add this note, you know, you suspend this note over this chord and it does this effect, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. You brought up Danny Elfman, and of course that Batman score is fantastic. And I hear those notes.
You know, he does not know theory, by the way. Danny Elfman.
Danny Elfman?
He doesn't know theory.
Well, that was, you know, I met Mark Mothersbaugh one time and I was kind of just picking his brain, you know. And I was like, you know, because I, you know, I score, and you know, not like those guys, but I score.
Yeah, kids shows.
Yeah. And, just kids shows. You know? No, I mean it's a big. It's amazing to get to do it. I'm not putting it down, but I was kind of like, you know, how do you do it? And I asked them, I asked them about orchestration and music theory, and he's like, you don't really have to know that. And then at some point I asked him about modular synthesizers. And I think by this point he's very cool to me, but I think he was getting kind of like annoyed, like, okay, you know,
enough questions.
He's like, oh, you'll never make it in this business if you don't learn about modular synthesizers. You know,
it's kind of like, is that true? He's kind of like, is that what he said?
Very sarcastically, like,
oh, okay.
Like, you know.
Yeah, you've said enough. Like, it's funny because you bring up Danny Elfman. Great Batman score, so many great scores. You bring up Mark Mothersbaugh, and these are people, along with, you know, Trent Reznor and Johnny Greenwood, who are in successful pop bands and then have pivoted very successfully to scoring, composing, all that stuff. Are those people, like, do you aspire to that kind of a transition in your own life?
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, composition was always the thing I wanted to do. It was, I mean, literally, there were two things that I wanted to do as a kid. I either wanted to do, I wanted to score movies, or I wanted to do funny voices. That was pretty much it, you know.
Right.
And singing in a band really came out of the funny voices. I didn't know I could sing. It was just another impersonation for me. You know, I would do voices around the house and stuff, and you know, and so singing was just, you know, for a few years, it was just me impersonating other bands because I, you know, like whatever. That was just
who were you impersonating? Yeah.
Oh, I would do all sorts of stuff. I did Elvis Costello and I did Sting and I did you know, Ray Charles, and I would do AC/DC and I would do Frank Sinatra. You know, I would just do all these singing impressions. But then I would also do a lot of, you know, I was really obsessed with Saturday Night Live. And so I would also do any of the impressions they would do. And, you know, I would learn all the, you know, I would try to do all the Phil Hartman stuff or the Dana Carvey stuff anyway. So, you know, that was one facet of it, but then the scoring was like always there. That was like the main thing. So when I started the band, you know, it's funny because usually singers in bands, they have their inner turmoil that they want to share, or they have their, you know, their journal. That I didn't have any of that. I just wanted to compose music, and I didn't know anything about how to get into film or anything, you know? So writing music for a band was the, you know, as close as I could get, I thought. Yeah. And then, I had done some voices on this movie, Gnome Alone. And, I kind of bluffed my way into scoring the Hulk ride at Universal Orlando.
Wow.
What? Awesome.
And so so Gnome Alone had heard that. And one of the producers, I'm in the vocal booth, doing these gnomes,
doing these little gnome guys.
And, one of the producers comes in, they go, "Hey, I heard you score." And I go, "Yeah."
And they go, "With chicks."
Yeah. And they go, "Yeah, totally." They go, "Would you like to score this movie?" And I was like, you know, and which that's not usually how it goes down. Yeah. but I was like, sure, you know, I'll see if I can, you know, schedule it in. Yeah. But you know. But from there, that's just kind of off to the races. And that's kind of been every day since then. I've been working on something. So
can we go back to the lead singer torment for a second? Because I was in like a college band and we had this singer and his name was Alex Dust, and he wore sunglasses.
Cool name.
And he wasn't very vocally gifted, but it was always like, Alex doesn't want to rehearse, and he's locked himself in the bathroom. I mean, there was nothing at stake, right? But it was like literally like he was Axl Rose. Did you ever feel any pressure to do that? Or were you ever like, God, I should just act out and it would actually help me in this situation?
You know, I feel like I didn't really accept that I was the singer for years, because I was kind of like, for a really long time, for many, many years, I was kind of holding out for us to find somebody that I was going to be like, I really thought I would be like, you know, the guitar player that sings harmonies or something. That's kind of what I expected to do. I didn't really plan on being the singer. So, you know, we had a couple albums out and I was still kind of like pitching guys. I'd be, you know, in the band, I'd be like, "Hey, what about this guy?" And they're like, "I don't know, man, you're kind of, you sing for the band at this point."
But didn't you start as the drummer in the band?
No, well, so I didn't actually start as the drummer. I had only ever played drums in bands before this one. And I was auditioning kind of. So Pete and Joe were putting together a band and they needed a drummer, a guitar player, or a singer, or in some combination. And I was like, I could do one of those. But I knew that meant that I was going to play drums, because I'd only ever played drums.
Yeah.
And the thing was, I was substantially better at drums than I was at anything else, you know. So, so I knew that I would. What's that?
So you thought.
Yeah. Well, that was singing was never, you know, singing in punk rock. I was in more decidedly punk bands prior to this. And my voice wasn't really a good thing in those bands, you know, because one of those things where I would sing, you know, there was a band, Hot Water Music, and they had these really gruff voices. And everybody wanted to sound like that. Or there was where there were these bands like Blood Brothers and Satia and whatever, was like really screaming and whatever, and or kind of yelling and whatever. And so I would do those voices, you know, kind of like trying to back up, you know, for our singers or whatever. And at some point it would always veer into my actual voice and they'd be like, "Yeah, it's too pretty, you know?" And so I didn't really think I never really thought of it as a thing. It just kind of was like, whatever. And I go to show them some songs that I had written and, you know, trying to pitch the song because that was the thing I really cared about.
Yeah.
And they go, you know, oh, you should sing. And I was like, okay, but, you know, was the song okay?
What
you
about
know?
My song?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Well, it's funny that you bring that up that, you know, at the at that time, there were these other bands and punk rock wanted to sound like those bands. And I feel like it was interesting for you at the point in your career when other bands were trying to sound like you?
Yes.
The weirdest thing about it is that I didn't notice. I'd done an interview for a book, like a kind of oral history on emo or whatever. Yeah. And someone sent me a copy. And I was reading the thing. And one of the things that I didn't really notice at the time, you know, is in, when other people are recounting it, you know, the idea that there was a kind of sound and that we were part of it at the time.
Yeah.
I had no idea. You know, I was kind of literally when we wrote the record that was kind of like the big one in that era, I sat down and I told my parents, you know, I'll do this and just let me fail at this and then I'll go to college, you know.
It's kind of like, amazing.
You know? So yeah, so the thing of like bands sounding like us, it's also one of those things where I think it's really interesting. So I used to work but before I worked at Sam Goody, I also worked at a used record store. And one of the things about the used record store that was really interesting is that you get really acquainted with failure. Because that's what people let go of, you know, that's what people sell off, you know.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any copies of the record with the hit on it. We would always have like 20 copies of the record after that one, you know.
Yeah. Right.
So I kind of assumed that was where this was going to go, you know. After we put out the first record, I was like, okay, well, naturally then there was this great ska band in Chicago, sort of ska, sort of almost prog, a real crazy, called the Blue Meanies, and I loved them. And they had this amazing record, Full Throttle. And then they got signed to the major label. And they put out the major label record, you know, just disappeared. Yeah. That's what I assumed was
Fallout
life,
Boys.
You know? I just want to point out that what you just said about the used record store and you becoming very acquainted with failure, that speech would be so great in a movie, in the right movie. Yeah. A character.
It was so good.
I mean, that's a terrific character speech of someone who's quietly and inadvertently studied failure.
Yeah, well,
and knows everything home, about it. I mean, seriously.
Yeah,
that is that definitely hit home. And now so let's talk for a minute, because I think in the history of rock and roll, I put the name Fallout Boy in the top 10 of all bands. Like, I think it's a fucking fantastic name. And obviously, you know, for those of us who are in comedy in this world, we know that that comes from The Simpsons. So who are the big Simpsons fans in the band? I mean, it sounds like you probably are as a fan of comedy.
Yeah, well, myself and Joe, who is also a huge fan of comedy, he and Brian Posehn have done a bunch of stuff together. I think they have a comic book maybe or a... I don't know. They've done a bunch of stuff, but Joe has, here's the thing. I'm like a comedy, like nerd that like, you know, just, I nerd out about comedy and stuff. Joe like kind of is a comedian that happened to end up in a band, you know?
Right.
Right.
So he's actually cool and can actually hang out with comedians. Like I still, you know, it's funny, you know, I told that story about Patton Oswalt. I think like Joe hangs out with him like regularly, like, you know, whatever. It's like,
right.
You know, he doesn't have the same freak out that I have. So he and I actually, that was a big thing that we bonded on when we started the band, was that both of us were deep Simpsons people. And we had a drummer, actually our first drummer was like obsessed with the Simpsons, had like a wall of Simpsons memorabilia.
Right.
And so he had kind of mentioned, you know, we had thrown out a bunch of names, and I don't remember for sure if that was one of his names, the first drummer, but it ended up on the cutting room floor. We didn't pick it. But then one of our friends, actually this band, Rise Against, Tim from Rise Against, he had another band. We were opening for them. And he was like, he had heard about Fall Out Boy as one of the names. And he was like, that's your name. I don't like your other names.
Great. Way to go, Tim.
And we're like, no, you know, I don't know. We don't like that one. He's like, no, it's going to be your name. And so we played that show and he was like, I want to thank Fall Out Boy. And at And that was it. And then it just kind of stuck, you know?
What were you before you decided? Remember. Oh, you don't start it.
I don't remember. And the thing is that people were kind of shouting it out too in the crowd. There were like, you know, 15 people there, but it was like, you should be Fall Out Boy. He's like, yeah, you should be Fall Out Boy. Fall Out Boy. Thank you. And
it stuck. That's awesome.
What an amazing origin story.
Yeah.
And now because Fall Out Boy, I mean, not only is it a cool name for, you know, if you're a Simpsons fan, it makes you kind of chuckle. But also, it is the perfect name for you guys to tour forever, because it's just one of those names where it lands with everybody. Like, even if people are not familiar with your songs or the genre necessarily, they see the name and they're like, oh yeah, yes, I've heard of them. Yes, that checks.
Yeah.
And so it just seems like it can be on any poster for the next like 30 years if you guys like it.
It's so weird. I don't know. I mean, it's all surreal to me. I kind of, you know, like I said, I think there's, I'll never be cool. Even, you know, in my own head, I'll never be cool. So it'll never, you know, track for me. That like, it feels very silly sometimes. We did this show a couple months ago with the Foo Fighters and Public Enemy was there and whatever. And so, and then we played and, and the thing that was really cool. What's that?
I said the way you said that.
Yeah, but it was crazy. I mean, like, why would anyone do that? You know, it just seems so improbable and weird and surreal. But
well,
just constantly It sounds like you're constantly dissociating or something.
I guess so. I mean, I don't know. Steve Carell said something one time that somebody asked him about, you know, how. You know, Steve, you seem like not a dick. You know, how did that happen? You know, because a lot of big, you know, a lot of people in your position would be kind of dicks. And he's like, well, I was kind of like 40 by the time anyone paid attention to me. So like I had some time to like, you know, build it. I was like 19, but I've been like, you know, 45 since I was like 15. So like, yes. I think that kind of helped. You know?
I think we can relate to that on this podcast. Well, so now we've talked about, you know, why us, and I can't believe we're playing with these people. When was the moment when you realized that Fall Out Boy, you know, had made it? Like, what, because obviously you talk about you released this album that does really well, but was there a tour? Was there a moment where, like you said, with Foo Fighters and Public Enemy, like where you're touring and all of a sudden you're sharing a bill with, you know, someone and you're like, oh, fuck.
A large check, perhaps?
Well, no, because the thing about the large checks, I'm in a weird, sorry, it's a side tangent, but.
No, please.
You know, I'm just old enough that we saw the tail end of the record industry where they would give you they give everybody a lot of money.
Yeah.
And the thing you don't realize when you're 19 is that money, that's a loan and that's forever.
Recoupable.
You
know,
like,
yeah.
So if they give you $2 million and you're like, wow, that's $2 million. That's all. If you only earn, you know, if you only make, you know, $30,000 a year off of being in a band, you're still paying back $2 million. I mean, it's not crazy. $2 million. Like it's you just took out a big loan. You didn't realize. You
know? I didn't know that.
That's I mean, is there interest?
There's not interest, but it's, okay. But the thing, but what they can do is that, you know, depending on how your contract's written, you basically don't get to ever put out another record until you pay that off. Like, you know, like if they decide that if you're a little band and you, I mean, this is the way it was anyway. If you're a little band and you sign a contract and they give you this big record advance and you're like, wow, gee, look at this, you know, and you go and buy a Lamborghini or something. The problem is that then if you don't generate enough, you know, if your songs aren't really working and they decide to shelve you, that's it. That's you're done in music pretty much forever. And so, and they probably won't go after you for the Lamborghini, but like, you will never make another record, like, because they own you and it's their prerogative to say, God, you're not worth putting more money into. So you just don't get to put out another record. So anyway, so my mom is an accountant, and that was one of the ways that I understood this.
Yeah. Nice.
Like, So I got that first check and I was like, wow, what do I get? And she's like, nothing. She's like, she's like, hold on to this. Like, don't, you know, don't be stupid because, you know, this might be all the money you ever get. And for a long time, she was right. You know, so,
wow. You're so lucky to have
good job,
that.
Mom.
But I interrupted it. I feel like what was a good question by Alec. Which
just like what was the moment when you realized like, holy fuck, we're sharing the stage with so-and-so. And so, like, I can't believe it.
I told this story. I was going to say
when we met on Warp Tour, we met because this is what I thought. At the time, they choose like basically the biggest band that's on tour at that moment to serve lunch for that week. And that's what you were doing. Do you remember? That's how we met.
We were doing lunch. I don't think it was the biggest band. I think it was rotating. And if I remember right, we earned that as punishment.
What?
Yeah.
So I think this whole time I thought it was for something else.
No, it wasn't because you're the biggest band. I think I can't remember what we did wrong, but we did something wrong. And well, I think thankfully, that was our punishment was that we had to do lunch, which I was fine with serving everybody. That wasn't the thing, but it was, we had done something, you know, in terms of like, I don't remember if we parked in the wrong place or if we,
oh my God, that is hilarious.
We were out with, on that tour, it was Billy Idol and The Offspring. Those were like the headliners.
Yeah.
And so we would show up and it would be like, you know, get your stuff, you know, and whatever. It wasn't very glamorous for us.
Right.
But no, I'd say the big moment, I've told this story before, so sorry if this is a canned answer, but it is the moment that I was like, well, this is different. Was we did this show called Skate and Surf Festival, and we did it a few years in a row, but this one year we do it, and by chance there were like three stages, and one was in a like theater, and another one was in like another space, but then another stage was just kind of in the hallway between the two, in the corridor between the two. So we were playing, we were going to start playing, and about 500 people were expected to show up, you know, for us, which, you know, because we were kind of building. So at that point, that was a big crowd for us. That would have been a big deal for us to play to 500 people in Jersey. And somebody, I think it was the Bouncing Souls, somebody was messing around with a fire extinguisher backstage, and it screwed with the fire alarm. And so they... like security forced everybody to evacuate that one room, the big theater. And it also required the other one to leave. So now everybody's waiting in the corridor, and Skate and Surf, you know, they're like, well, for our stage, they're like, well, your stage is kind of in the open, so you don't have to worry about this. Your show can go on. We don't know this. I don't know any of this. So I go up on stage, and by chance, you know, this never happens, but all of the label came out to see us and everything. At the time, L.A. Reid was the head of Island. So he's there. And and before we go on stage, he goes, I got good news and bad news. He goes, you know, the bad news is I like hits. It's like, the good news is you got hits. Right? And I'm like, okay, I don't know. You know, I'm 20 and this sounds... You know,
it's like terrified. Neutral news and good news.
Yeah, totally.
You liking hits is not bad news.
Yeah. And so that's like right before we go up and we would do this thing where we high five before we start. And because of the nature of where I stand, I always have my back turned, so I couldn't see anything. So I go up and we high five, and then I turn around, and now there's 5,000 people there.
Wow. And
the thing that was weird was that, you know, most of them didn't know who we were. Most of them, you know, it was kind of an accident. But by this chance of fate, like, we killed it to like 5,000 people in Jersey. Wow. And that kind of changed
what year
trajectory.
Was this?
Well, I don't remember, 2005, 2004, no, it's about five maybe.
Wow. Must have been.
It was after Corktree, I think. So it was like this thing. So that was kind of a moment where I was like, not necessarily that we made it, but like, this is different than my friends' bands. This is different than like I said, all the bands that I've been in Chicago, or my friends have been in Chicago, this was something that none of them had experienced that I didn't have a barometer for. And so I was like, this is beyond me. I don't know where anything is now.
That's so cool. That's a, you know, story. It's funny you say like you expected 500 people and that's a good crowd. I don't think 500 people saw me do stand up in my entire career. Like spread over my entire career.
Stand up is a terrifying thing. I was thinking the other day about this this guy I saw one time at a little stand up festival in somewhere in LA, and we had gone, me and some friends had gone to see another friend, and we were the only people in the audience. It was like five of us, and so we were there cheering on our friend. But the guy that opened was really funny. I remember he was, I think, from Egypt, and he had a lot of bits about you know, being Egyptian American and stuff. Yeah. And I was like, man, that is, and I've done those shows, but I think it's even hard. It must be even more difficult to do as a stand up because you're you. Like,
yeah.
But so much of it is that for years that you become kind of immune to it.
Right.
I think that's part of the thing, the aura of comedy to me is that I feel like there's a thing that, I really wanted to be a comedian when I was little. And then the first time I saw someone get heckled, I was like, oh, nope, never mind.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. That's great.
You made a way better choice.
Yes, you did. You did. I want to go back to something that you, and we'll wrap it up here soon. You've been very generous this morning. I appreciate it. But first, you talked about this thing, which I did not know, that when a record label gives you $2 million, that's a loan, which I think is crazy. I did not know that.
It's called, like, think of it as like
a, I mean, it's not really a loan, but it's...
But I get what you're saying. They expect you to pay that back.
Eventually, like
through record sales.
Yes.
But so my perception as an outsider, and maybe you can clarify this a little bit, is that the record industry for decades and decades was incredibly crooked, and then it just got blown apart by Napster, and now they're finding like new ways to be crooked in this digital age. Like, is that something that, as a musician on the inside, do you kind of look at the industry and you're like, God, all these people are just trying to take our money all the time?
The weirdest thing about the record industry, I think, is that there's really not one size fits all. So when I started, I had this really, you know, cause it came from punk rock. I had this very, very specific idea of major labels. For example, I was like, major labels are all the assholes.
Yeah.
Then you watch, or you get screwed over, you watch your friends get screwed over, or you get screwed over by indie labels and you're like, Oh, like,
yeah,
it's, you know,
it's
whatever.
Everywhere. And it's rampant.
Yeah. Well, and it's, so it's not, oh, it's not this black and white thing. And weirdly, I've known total assholes and morons at major labels, but then I've also known some really great people, you know, and some of the people we've worked with for a long time at major labels have been cooler and more reasonable than some of the people I knew in indie labels, you know? So that's been interesting. And the thing is that there's not one size fits all. And the thing that I took away from it is the thing that I've taken away from it in the long run is that regardless of where it is, it's really kind of poor business to be a dick, to be exploitative of your artists or whatever, or to be an artist that's exploitative, whatever.
Short-sighted.
It really doesn't, it doesn't pay in the long run. You know, we've been very lucky, but I also think that we've probably been lucky in part because we haven't really pissed everybody off. You know, I think that's part of the thing. And I'm sure it's the same in writing and in comedy and in film and in TV, you know, like I'm sure that it helps to not be a pain to work with, you know?
Yeah. We talk about that a lot.
Absolutely. It does. All right. Well, that's very interesting. And now, so let's, because, you know, move over Trent Reznor. Let's talk about Patrick Stump scoring. So you've got some irons in the fire now that you're working on. What kind of stuff can we expect to hear from you coming out?
Well, so the reason I wanted to mention something is that I did a documentary for a buddy of mine that is currently playing right now. Today is the 13th of February. It is playing at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival.
Oh.
or did it just play yesterday? Shoot. Okay, it's over now. But it played it played the 8th and it played the 12th.
So what's it called? What's the documentary called?
So it's called 76 Days, and it's about a guy that gets lost for 76 days at sea. And he survives, but he's just so interesting. He's like such a, he's so matter of fact about it. And it was really fun to score because he kind of, you know, he's like, yeah. And then a shark, I don't know, you know, like he just doesn't really, he doesn't, you know, this guy is surviving on rainwater and, you know, trying to grab fish with his bare hands, you know?
Right.
And
did you have to create the drama with your music since he wasn't?
Yeah, actually, that's exactly it. Is that it put this, it put me in this place where I had to, because he, yeah, he has this way of just being so kind of like, well, you know, whatever. And, but then the way that it's directed, the way that my friend Joe directed it, when he does the reenactment stuff, it is very thrilling.
Cool.
So you have to find a balance where it's like, it has to be thrilling, but then also not so thrilling that you can't hear this guy be like, yeah, so.
Right. Yeah. Can't bury
so
him.
So that just came out. I also did a movie that I really wish I got to talk about. For some reason, I didn't do any press on it. Merry Little Batman, that came out around Christmas. It's a cartoon holiday movie where Batman has his son Damian, and it's kind of like Home Alone where he gets, Batman is away on Batman business, and then you know, all the villains try and take over the Batcave. So
can you see that anywhere now?
That's on Amazon Prime. So.
Okay, cool.
So, and I do have a soundtrack for that. They put out a soundtrack on streaming and stuff, which I was really excited about.
Oh, cool.
That's awesome.
And then meanwhile, I'm doing Spidey and His Amazing Friends for Disney, which I do.
That's awesome.
Ongoing forever.
And you also have a theme song for that, right?
Yeah, I did the theme song. Yeah, I did the theme song, and then I also do all the music on that show.
That's great.
So that one's fun. And, you know, I'll do that as long as they'll have me. And I'm just wrapping up the first season of a show called Hot Wheels Let's Race for Netflix. So
cool.
So, that's animated as well?
Yeah, it's animated. Yeah.
Awesome.
That's awesome. So it seems like you're getting a real foothold in in this world, because that's a lot of stuff. And, you know, I mean, is the dream like, I know you love what you're doing. You love scoring. And not, this is not to minimize like an animated show, because listen, that's where we work. So
the animation, I don't know. I mean, the real stuff isn't animation.
But is it something like where you watch There Will Be Blood and you're like, one day?
Well, the thing that's weird for me is that, you know, I'm a comic book guy. I like comic books and I like comedy and I like sci-fi. So it's like there are aptitudes that kind of puts you in. So naturally I do kind of tend towards animation, or I tend towards superhero stuff, or I tend towards, you know, fantasy and action adventure stuff. I've done some kind of elevated horror stuff and that kind of thing, or it would be cool to do. It'd be really interesting to do a drama, but I've never been asked to do a drama. But yeah, I feel like, I wonder if I'll ever end up there. I wonder if I'll ever, you know, have a chance to do anything musically where I would get to do something like There Will Be Blood, because it's like, it's weird. I think, you know, part of it might be my aptitude, but part of it is also like, you are who you are, you know, and I've watched way more Marvel movies and way more Family Guy than I've watched, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson movies. I've seen them, but it's, and I love them, and I love high art. And I feel like I have something I could contribute to it, but at the end of the day, I'm still gonna gravitate towards
geek out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. I don't know, but I would love to be doing that for forever. You know, it's something that, you know, singing is hard. Singing is very hard.
I don't know if you guys know this, but
tends to strain your throat a little bit, right?
Yeah, and it's just the whole thing. It takes so much out of you, and sometimes it's physically so demanding. And I like that scoring, I get to express myself, but it's never taxing, you know, because it's like, I have responsibilities, I have kids, I have, you know, things to do. But if I, in a vacuum, if I had, you know, something to score, I could be doing that nonstop and not run out of things, because not run out of ideas and not run out of, there's something exciting about that, that being in a band is different than, because there's a physical component in a band where you're like, you know, I'm just, you know, wiped.
To be on.
Yeah.
Well, you seem to me like the kind of person who's going to get those opportunities, because as you sort of alluded to even before, like, you're not a dick. Like, you're not a diva, you're not one of those people that seems like they're difficult to work with. And certainly in the experiences that we've had at Family Guy working with you, you've been an absolute delight, and you've always nailed it every time. So,
by the way, I was going to say, you know, earlier when you were saying, you know, Colby, when you were saying the thing about like, oh, is it like, you know, is this like the most real job, you know, for me, when I show up to Family Guy, I'm just there for like the table read and then the whatever. I'm not there for like all the stuff. So for me, it's like, oh, this is easy. It took me half an hour. What are you guys talking about? You know,
totally.
Yeah. Well, it's easy for you because you come in and nail it. So
yeah, that's true.
We appreciate that. And so let me just to recap, 76 Days is the documentary. Spidey and Friends.
Yeah.
Is the show, and Merry Little Batman on Amazon Prime. Yes. And of course, Fallout Boy, and you guys are going to be going out on tour next month.
That sounds exhausting.
Yeah. It is. Yeah.
You know, when you're kind of a nerd, and you're not going to like party too hard, there's not that much to do on tour when you're not on stage. So scoring is like, it's great.
Perfect. That's awesome.
The Led Zeppelin, the days of Led Zeppelin touring are over. Where
that was never really for me anyway.
Does your airplane have a fireplace like this?
Led Zeppelin? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we had to replace the one.
There was a little problem midair.
I don't know. It was, you know, gas. They didn't want gas in there. So
somebody had a problem with it. And thanks, Sleepy Joe. Anyway, Patrick, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me.
JC, thank you for bringing this man into our lives.
Of course.
We appreciate that. Patrick, you're always awesome on the show, and we can't wait to hear what
you're doing. Always glad to do it. Always
love
great to see you guys.
Thank you, Patrick.
Have a good one.
You too. Oh, God, Patrick Stump, what a nice guy.
That was fun
talking to him. Rock stars are just cool. I know he says he's not cool, but he's just way cooler.
Yeah.
They just start cooler than
especially humble rock stars.
No, a humble rock star. Lead singer, no less.
Yes.
It's a rare thing.
Yes.
Fun talking to him. And now fun to get into a portion of the show we like to call Top 5.
Top 5.
Oh, beautiful. All right, Goldie, this was your topic. Lead us off.
Okay, this is the top 5 movies or TV shows you've never seen.
Yes.
Number 5. I have never seen a single episode of The West Wing.
Oh, that's such a treat.
I know President Bartlett.
Liberal porn.
I don't know what that is. Okay. Number 4. I've not seen Lost.
Oh, yeah,
me either.
I know a plane crashes. That's it. Number 3. I have never seen a single episode of Law and Order.
Oh, what? God, that kills me. I've seen enough for you, by the way.
Number 2, Spartacus.
Same. Yeah.
I am Spartacus. I don't know what that is. Good for you.
It ain't that
you
great.
May be Spartacus. I'm confused. And number
nice
1,
to meet you, Spartacus.
And you know I've never seen this, and I feel like I never will, because it's cooler not to have. Star Wars.
Yeah, it's annoying.
Yeah.
It's annoying. It's almost like the we don't own a TV. It's like, all right,
we'll get one.
Get
way
one.
Better.
Okay, so now it's me.
Yes.
Number 5, a movie called Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Hmm. I feel like people love talking about that movie, and I just quietly never saw it, but I'm sure it's very good. Number 4, and this is a little cheating because it's something I've tried to watch, but continue to fall asleep and have never seen. I've seen less than half of it, so I'm counting it. 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Oh, wow.
It's not good.
I mean, I love sci-fi. I love Kubrick. So it's like I want to be into it, but it does not hold me and I fall asleep.
So that's one. Okay.
Well, there's a lot of silence in it. Maybe that's
a lot of silence. And then when the voices come in, they're like very soothing.
They're very. Yes.
Number three, Breaking Bad.
Yes. Mm. You
got to see it.
It's well, good. You know, the thing is, I've started it a couple times and people are like, well, it gets slow. You wait till season six, you know, episode seven. It's like, well, I don't
just
have 7 hours.
Just watch the pilot. Just watch the pilot.
I did. And it didn't hold me. Okay.
Oh my God.
Number two, The Wire. Everybody talks about The Wire, how great The Wire. It was before Breaking Bad. The Wire was Breaking Bad in terms of like, you have to see this.
The first two episodes are so slow and then it's incredible. Okay. But they lose everyone.
I know. I started watching it and it was like a guy making models in a basement. And I'm like, what am I watching here? Okay. And number one, we've talked about it on this podcast. The second half of the Pats Falcons Super Bowl. Famously not there. Okay. That's my list, JC. What's yours?
That's great. Okay. My number five is Annie Hall.
Oh, that's a great one.
Number four is Mr. Show. The show, Mr. Show.
Oh.
I know.
Hilarious. I don't know how it would seem today, but it was fucking hilarious. At the
time. Still feel like I should watch it for references.
It's right there on Max.
Like
available on Max.
Thank you. Number three, Citizen Kane.
Great.
Citizen Kane.
Great.
Number two, 30 Rock.
Yeah.
I've never seen 30 Rock.
It's good. I don't think I'll ever watch it again, but I did like watching it.
It's not The Office.
No.
Okay. And my number one is, we had crossover, is The Wire.
Yeah.
I've never seen it.
There we go.
Yeah.
Why are we watching? All right. That's terrible. All right, JC, it's your top five next week. What do we got?
Okay. Next week, top five conspiracy theories.
Hmm. Oh.
Okay.
Yes.
I love that.
Why, thank you.
And you know what? I thought last week went so well without a high note. Should we fucking do it again?
Sure. I would just want to say something because my high note, and it won't work next week. It's Alex Sulkin's birthday this week. And I'm going to celebrate our co-host. Nice. Very glad you were born.
Birthday.
You've been a terrific friend. I enjoy our time together.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
That's very well said. Well, let's let that
be. That's barely said. I mean, it was literally the least I could get away with saying.
There he is. He's back. He was gone for 15 seconds and now he's back. Well, I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to the redemption song from my birthday last year. Where
you mean this one?
Happy birthday.
Yes. There it is. I can feel the feel the love tonight. Anyway, Patrick Stump, fantastic.
My high note.
Patrick Stump, great job. Love talking to you.
Yeah, he's
thank you all for listening. Thank you two for being awesome.
Thank
and
you.
We will talk to you again next week.
Just sends chills down my spine.
Is that Morrissey getting upset about next week?
It was.
That was fun.
And it stops right now.
The wicked glitch of the West.